This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's have a little inspiration. Boston, Massachusetts, New England, we are a region of history, and those who make it, enlighteners, challengers of the status quo, even revolutionaries, the ways they have changed the world affect the way we live today, and sometimes what they did is also just plain cool, like cutting up and selling ice. Now, if you've ever seen that done, it was probably in the Disney film Frozen.
This icy force, both foul and fair, has a frozen harbor lining.
That'll be 40.
40? No, 10.
Oh dear, that's no good. See, this is from our winter stock. For the supply and demand to have a big problem.
You want to talk about a supply and demand problem? I sell ice for a living.
Ooh, that's a rough business to be in right now. I mean, that is really... that's unfortunate.
You'd have to go to fiction to see it, because cutting up pond ice and selling it is a thing of the past. But it was big business, and it took off after an invention by an engineer in Cambridge. Now, journalist Karen Weintraub and her husband, Michael Kukta, have a new book out that tracks all kinds of interesting ideas and people who were, according to the book's title, born in Cambridge, 400 years of ideas and innovators. We're going to talk about a few of those with her today. Karen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much. So great to be here.
It's great to have you. And I kind of feel like we got to start with the ice, right? You got 400 years of innovators, but let's start right there. Nathaniel Wyeth. Now, back up a little. Tell us how selling pond ice even came to be.
Sure. So everybody in Cambridge thinks that the field originated in Cambridge. Not quite true, but Frederick Tudor had this great idea in 1806 to sell ice to people in the Caribbean because they didn't have any. And so he began shipping it down there. At first, he kept his idea a secret because he didn't want other people to steal his brilliant idea. When they found out, they laughed at him. They thought it was hilarious that anybody would try to send ice to the Caribbean by boat, obviously, in those days. They didn't think it would make it that far. Much of it melted on the way, and the rest that made it kind of confused people. They didn't know what ice was. They didn't know how to use it. He would convince bartenders to give drinks with free ice to get people hooked on cold drinks and teach them how to make ice cream. But the business was not doing well. He was in debtor's prison twice. He was in deep trouble until he met this guy named Nathaniel Wyeth, who had grown up in Cambridge on the shores of Fresh Pond. His father owned a hotel there. And Wyeth figured out how to carve giant blocks of ice out of Fresh Pond. Hard for us to imagine today that Fresh Pond was really that frozen over
right.
in those days, but it was. And he came up with this device, passing a plow pulled by horses would scrape out the squares, and then another pass would dig them out. And they were able to get these giant blocks. They put them in sawdust, and they made it in the ship's hull all the way to India, 14,000 miles away. And the British loved these guys. They said it was the greatest invention since the potato had come to Europe, because they were so happy to have cold drinks again. So he became a bit of a hero. He couldn't stay in one place very much. So Wyeth launched two expeditions to the Pacific Northwest, and actually is also considered one of the founders of Portland, Oregon. Huh. So kind of an interesting guy.
So I will say, A, I did not see the potato to ice comparison coming. So that's a new one for me. But also, so Wyeth was like an inventing machine when it came to this industry. According to the Dictionary of American Biography, quote, "It was said at his death that practically every implement and device used in the ice business had been invented by Nat Wyeth," end quote.
He was a very creative guy, and we've had a lot of them in Cambridge over 400 years, which was sort of the point of this book. Not everybody was born in Cambridge, but Wyeth was, and all the ideas that we talk about. We took a little literary license with the idea.
Yeah. All right. So listen, I actually find this industry fascinating, but we've got three women that I
yes.
want to get to. So the rest, we're going to focus on women for the rest of the time here. They butted up against limitations of their times, and they found a way to break through. And what's interesting is sometimes more subtly than at other times. So let's start with Anne Bradstreet. I want to start there because she's the furthest back in history among our group of women that we're talking about here. Tell us a little bit about her.
So she arrived in what was then called Newtown for the first 2 years of its existence in 1630.
And that was Cambridge, just for
that
people,
was
right?
Cambridge
yeah.
exactly. And in fact, the we don't even know how to spell it. Everybody spelled it differently, but whether it was one word or two and how many capitals. But it was pretty wild back then. There was the river was not embanked. It was swamp. There wasn't much here. They had to cut their own trees for firewood. Half the people who arrived on the ship that she took over from England died that first winter of starvation. It was pretty miserable times. There's a Harvard gate that's named for Bradstreet, kind of facing the Science Center, and it quotes her saying, "I came to this country where I found a new world and new manners, at which my heart rose." And to our ears, that sounds like she was singing, "My heart rose,
right.
Thrilled to be here." But in those days, it meant it made her want to throw up.
Lovely.
So yeah, it was such a hostile, horrible place. And she got sick. She had 1630. She had a 2-year-old. She was 19 years old. She just arrived. It's less than a year earlier, and she almost died. And instead of just kind of plowing through her miserable existence, she wrote a poem about it.
So called "Upon a Fit of Sickness." Right?
Sickness, exactly.
And you're going to read us a little bit of that?
A little bit. I'll read the first and last lines. So, "Twice 10-year old, not fully told." So she was 19. "Since nature gave me breath, my race is run. My thread is spun. Lo, here is fatal death. The race is run, the field is won, the victory's mine, I see. Forever known thy envious foe, the foil belongs to thee." So to our ears, it sounds a little rhymey and maybe a little simplistic, but Adrian Rich, the poet who helped resurrect Bradstreet's reputation in the 1960s, described it as unadorned and simple. She wrote about her own illness, not some Greek tragedy or other great subjects that were the common topics in those days. And Rich says Bradstreet kind of laid the groundwork for an American form of poetry, later picked up by Whitman and Robert Frost, who also lived in Cambridge later, so that she was sort of the precursor of American poetry.
And just briefly, one of the things that struck me in reading your passage on her was this idea that there were very few forms available to her to express herself. And poetry was one of them.
Right. Women in those days couldn't really speak out. They couldn't. Other women were banished from the colonies for being outspoken. And so she was extremely religious. So this was sort of a praise poem to God to thank God for still being alive. And she also was insistent that this poem and the others that she didn't write, she wrote later, not in Cambridge, be published. She wanted people to hear this voice, to hear from this new world.
So then we move to a woman who did speak out. And we've got a little bit of an echo going. I just want to acknowledge that. No, it's okay, Karen, but I just want to acknowledge it. I think it's better to just note it. So Margaret Fuller, who really, you want to talk about subtle versus crashing right through. Let's talk about Margaret Fuller.
Yeah, so she was also born in Cambridge in 1810 on Cherry Street, which is between Central and Kendall Squares. Her father was a U.S. congressman and didn't have a son for a while and educated Margaret as if she were one, which she obviously did very well with that, but it also created problems for her. She was one of the best educated people, certainly in Cambridge at the time. And then she meets, as a young woman, Ralph Waldo Emerson and becomes part of the Transcendentalist movement. She edits their journal, The Dial, for which she is promised payment and never receives it. her father has passed away, her brother is younger, so she's supporting the family on her teaching and her writing. But there were very few options open to her in those days. And she writes a book in 1845 called Woman in the 19th Century about the plight of women like herself. And this is 50 or 60, just to remind you, 50 or 60 years before the suffragette movement starts. So she's really on the vanguard of women's rights.
And heavily influences some of the suffragettes,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. And then she moves to New York to work for the New York Tribune. She becomes one of the first female journalists in the country, inspirational for those of us who followed in her footsteps. And in 1848, she goes to Italy to cover the Italian Civil War. She becomes America's first foreign correspondent. And tragically, on the way back in 1850, she took the cheap seats back on a boat and then ended up sinking right off the coast of New York, off Fire Island. And most of the other passengers survived, but she and her 2-year-old son and husband passed away. And Emerson was so devastated, he sent Thoreau to look for her remains. And supposedly she had a manuscript with her, but it was never found.
That's really incredible. I mean, the idea that Emerson sent Thoreau to find the remains of a woman whose manuscript was anticipated, you know, during that time, it does give us a sense of her legacy and her influence then. I do want to leave time here. I want to make sure we talk about Mariah Baldwin, who was a woman of color who pioneered against both gender and racial barriers. So tell us about her.
Exactly. So also born and raised in Cambridge. And now there's, if you're familiar with the Baldwin School in Cambridge, that's named for her. And that is the school where she taught for many, many years. She was principal for 33 years. When she got a temporary job, she wasn't able to get a full-time job in Cambridge when she first graduated. She was hired to teach sort of an extra classroom at what was then the Agassiz School. She was beloved. She ended up teaching every year, every age in that school, and eventually being named its principal. What's unusual about that is the student body and the other faculty were almost all white. And at the time, there were, we think she was certainly the only one in New England. We think she may have been the only one almost in the country, a black woman leading a white school. She was a progressive educator. She hired the city's first school nurse, created open air classrooms, parent teacher group, and was really beloved. If you've heard of the poet E.E. Cummings, famous for not including punctuation, he grew up nearby, went to the school, and once wrote about her, "Never did any demi-divine dictator more gracefully and easily rule a more unruly and less graceful populace. Her very presence emanated an honor and a glory." So she was beloved and an important figure, but she also led this double life.
Right,
as a
she
leader.
Was standing in two worlds.
Exactly. She was her home was sort of the home, I guess, for black intelligentsia in Boston and Cambridge at the time. Her house, which still stands on Prospect Street, was a meeting place for people like W.E.B. Du Bois, civil rights pioneer, who was the first African-American to receive a PhD from Harvard. Newspaper editor William Monroe Trotter would meet there and have deep conversations. Both of them went on to found the Niagara Movement, which became essentially the NAACP. So, you know, that they were really quite ahead of their time. And also that was kind of interesting that she created this format, this setting for them to share ideas.
Did you know about all three of these women when you set out to write the book, or were they hidden from you too?
I mean, I feel ignorant that I didn't know about them, but even Margaret Fuller, a journalist, and I've been a lifelong journalist, I hadn't heard of her. There is a great biography about her that's worth reading. No, I mean, this was a voyage of discovery for both of us, and that was what made it so much fun for us and what we hope will make it fun for people to read.
And as you researched it, any connective tissue across either these women or the ideas and innovations that were born in Cambridge over 400 years?
There were a number of lessons we tried to draw in the last chapter. And one of them that I think the women we talked about sort of exemplify is that they weren't just about themselves. They were working for the greater good, for something larger than themselves. They had a mission and an ideal. And I think that obviously that's true of many people in other places, but it was consistently true over four centuries in Cambridge from among a lot of people in a lot of different fields. And I think somehow that added to the fabric of the city and enabled Cambridge to survive and thrive for so long.
Okay, and in a sentence, and you may not be able to answer this, but 400 years from now, is there anybody living in Cambridge today that you think is in the next book?
There's a lot of genetic advances going on right now that I think will pass the test of time. A CRISPR-Cas9, which you've heard of, there's credit to go around, but some of it stays in Cambridge. I think that's going to be a big deal.
All right. And that is Karen Weintraub, journalist and co-author of Born in Cambridge, 400 Years of Ideas and Innovators. Her other co-author, Michael Kukta. Karen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.